소개합니다. 메리츠 신여보.
지고 아플 때도 어르신들 필수보장 메리츠에 다 있다네.
어르신을 위한 시니어보험도 역시 메리츠 화재. 갱신 시 보험료가 인상될 수 있으며 가입 시 유의사항을 확인하세요.
So 803, since predicting COVID-19 wouldn't be a problem in Iran some 2 weeks ago, the country's leaders have been scrambling to contain the virus that's claimed nearly 150 lives, including several officials. Only Italy seen more COVID-19 deaths outside China. Iran has responded by temporarily releasing more than 54,000 prisoners among its measures. To better understand the situation there, we welcome on the line the author of A Modern Contagion, Professor Amir Avkami of Psychiatry, Global Health and History at George Washington University, where he serves as Preclinical Education Director. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Considering President Hassan Rouhani dismissed concerns surrounding COVID-19 as groundless hysteria, how do we now read those comments in hindsight?
Well, obviously, the Iranian government has finally began to acknowledge what the world already knows, which is that Iran is in the midst of a very serious and extremely severe COVID-19 outbreak. And looking back, as I have explained in my past articles, the articles last week in Politico, Iran did its utmost to hide the extent of the virus and really under-responded to the potential outbreak as a way of protecting its economy and out of political interest and putting its image internationally and domestically ahead of the public welfare of its population. And in a sense, the current epidemic in Iran, the severity of the epidemic is a self-inflicted wound that is the result of bad policies and not responding adequately and robustly enough early on by the government in Tehran.
Why would Iran have been affected as opposed to any of its neighbors or in the wider region?
Well, Iran's most important trading partner is China. Iran, because of its already bad economic situation, was unwilling to in any way restrict its intercourse and exchange with China during the early phase of the outbreak in Wuhan, and as a result, opened really the venue for this virus to make its way into Iran. And once the epidemic first broke out in the country, the government, for reasons that included the need to continue to protect its economy, and also because of its desire to get a high showing at polls during parliamentary elections, refused to take a robust enough measure to try to limit the outbreak early on in the country, and subsequently doubled down on some of these policies. And in the ensuing 3 weeks, the epidemic grew to such proportions that now it will be extremely difficult for the Iranian public health system, which I may add is one of the best in the region, to grapple with this epidemic.
Especially from a religious point of view, we have seen profound discussions going on here in South Korea alone about the nature of a religious sect at the center of one of the biggest outbreaks in this country, but also even suspending mainstream church services and other gatherings. Iran, known for its religious fervor, how much of a threat is COVID-19 to that and its general viewpoint of society and the world?
Frankly, I would not chalk this up to religious fervor in Iran, but more so the role of religion in politics. and the inability of the government's public health branches to overcome religious barriers to adequate public health response, such as early on during the outbreak in the holy city of Qom, despite the government knowing that it needed to restrict and even bar entry into major shrines in the country, including the shrine of Imam Asume in Qom. The government was unable to do this due to the political power of the religious strata in Iran and their opposition to this type of public health intervention by the government.
Can we also talk about, I mean, from your expertise, going back to your book, A Modern Contagion, Imperialism and Public Health in Iran's Age of Cholera, that's the full title. You wrote then about Iran's rapid and effective response to avert the cholera epidemic in the recent past. How does this situation compare and why?
Well, you know, one of the examples I've given is Iran's response in 1965 to the El-Tor biotype of pandemic cholera, which really affected the world, including Korea. And the El-Tor strain that reached Iran in 1965 had similarities in its bacteriological profile to the current coronavirus, by virtue of being particularly virulent and difficult to contain due to the hardiness of the infection and the high rates of asymptomatic infections that did not result in illness but could still transmit the disease. Nevertheless, the Iranian government was able to rapidly mobilize a sizable public health workforce to quarantine affected areas and close its borders to countries that risked reintroducing the disease. And this allowed it to identify infected individuals while the illness was contained through robust laboratory analysis, and then go on to treat them with powerful broad-range antibiotics supplied by the United States, and also developed a vaccine that was twice as effective as its American counterpart, so very quickly contained this outbreak long before it was contained in industrial countries, you know, in its neighborhood, including the Soviet Union. The reason why the situation is different now is at that time, politics did not play a role in effective public health intervention. You know, when the Iranians started in 1965 a vaccination campaign, even members of the royal family were not excluded from that vaccination campaign. What we're seeing today in Iran is a situation where politics and politicized religion is playing a role in preventing effective public health interventions against a major outbreak.
Right.
The current coronavirus outbreak did not have to reach the extent it has reached in Iran. This is completely the result of the barriers that we're seeing within the Iranian government today.
Can I also just get your thoughts on how far this may have already spread or may yet spread? Officially, Iran has confirmed almost 6,000 infections and 145 Correct. Deaths as of the BBC's reporting in the last few hours. And I just wonder whether you suspect it's already much higher than that or could yet go much higher than that in the country.
I'm convinced it's significantly higher than that. I had the opportunity to look at some raw data on coronavirus infections from hospitals around Tehran, actually, the capital city. And based on that raw data, the Washington Post wrote an investigative piece that came out Thursday this past week. And projections by epidemiologists who looked at that raw data at that time, this is Wednesday, data from Wednesday of this past week, showed that Iran could potentially have up to 20,000 COVID-19 infections. This is back in Wednesday of last week. And the deaths that we were seeing on the data coming out of Tehran were significantly higher than what the government was reporting then. So I'm convinced that the government is still underreporting the number of infections and the number of deaths in the country.
Professor Afkami from George Washington University, author of A Modern Contagion, as I said before, dealing with Iran's age of cholera, but still something that's particularly interesting to read in hindsight, given what's going on right now. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
We can now shift our focus to the political implications. Iran-US relations. We have Behnam Bentaleblou, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, on the line, and thank you for taking the time.
Lovely to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Why do you see Iran as being reluctant to seek assistance from the international community? Can it be summarized by its challenges with the U.S. right now?
Well, in no small part, that is correct. We know that historically, when there have been natural disasters or other sorts of crises in Iran, particularly earthquakes, for instance, the U.S. has offered relief, and Iran has broadly rejected that relief for notions of national pride, as well as to not alter the trajectory of conflict and competition that the Islamic Republic finds itself on with the United States. I think more broadly now, because of the efficacy of the sanctions, Iran is trying to continue a long-sitting talking point to the regime, which is to try to find a foreign foe for the country's domestic problems, so that the latest crisis, despite being targeting many sectors of society, targeting regime elites themselves, they're trying to use this once again, most unfortunately, as a political moment. And it's really a shame because it's coming at the loss of constant Iranian lives.
We've heard voices in the U.S., including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, suggest Iran is suppressing vital details. In other words, covering up part of its outbreak. This is a problem, isn't it, in an area where we need global cooperation to defeat this outbreak?
That's right. And the less transparency and less cooperation we have, be it from Iran or other regional epicenters of the virus of COVID-19, the longer time we're going to have to spend trying to quarantine and contain the virus before we begin to roll back the tide, and whether that rollback is measured as the declining loss of lives, declining numbers of that, or the actual numbers of people who have actually become healthy again or have beat the virus.
From Tehran's perspective, though, you're dealing with a Trump administration that has backtracked on a deal that you had made with the Obama administration. And if we had an Iran government minister in the studio right now, I'm sure they'd put up a case that they can't trust the United States, and that, you know, why would they cooperate with the U.S. on this or any other issue? Has the U.S. undermined itself under this Trump administration to be able to be a global cooperator?
Well, not necessarily, because the trust case that you and I think others would be citing is the 2015 nuclear deal, the JCPOA. As you mentioned, Obama agreed to it and Trump walked away from it, albeit despite trying to fix it first with the Europeans in a very underreported attempt in 2018 to create transatlantic consensus on the deal's problems and then use that as a baseline to improve the deal and multilateralize it again. But ultimately, trust was not a causal factor in getting the Iranians to come to the table. It was actually the pain caused by the sanctions relief that allowed them to make a concession that would have been necessarily sufficient for the American side, as well as, of course, the secret track of negotiations between the Obama administration and Iran before they became public and before they multilateralized, in which the U.S. abandoned some of its longer-standing restrictions against Iran's nuclear program. So trust was not a causal factor then. It will not be a causal factor now. It's just, again, most unfortunate that that was a nuclear crisis and now this is a humanitarian crisis. And what drives one will not necessarily be what drives another.
We already had this tense situation with Iran, though, and mixed reporting on the public sentiment in Iran before this COVID-19 outbreak. If there's any sense that the government there underestimated the risks and is at fault for the problems the people there will now be feeling and facing, is there a risk of public unrest spilling out into calls for regime change or even more profound impacts?
Well, it definitely would exacerbate a trend we've seen since 2017, if not slightly earlier, which is that the space in time, the gap between each major protest against the regime is diminishing, which means the number of more anti-regime protests are growing, which actually is leading to these protests being led not by middle-class folks, but by blue-collar individuals, people who were supposed to be the next generation of the revolution. And they're using political grievances, social grievances, economic grievances, and now, dare I say, with the COVID-19 crisis, perhaps even public health policy issues, to make political points about the kind of representative government that they ultimately want and about the kind of foreign policy Iran should have and the kind of representation they want on the world stage. So it may be another vector in a popular talking point of the street against state in coming months.
Just a final word on how you see U.S.-Iran relations going forward. We went from what was viewed by some analysts as the brink of war just a few weeks ago to where we are now, countries looking inwardly to try to resolve this outbreak, at least through the lens of the media. What happens next, do you think?
I think 2020 is going to have more of the same of what we saw in 2019, but at a much greater intensity. Meaning there was U.S.-Iranian strategic competition in 2019. There were flashpoints where it looked like the diplomatic, the strategic, the intelligence wars were about to become overt, kinetic military wars. But they were tamped down or one side backed down at the last minute. We're likely to see a lot more of that this year, particularly as the U.S. gears up for its election cycle and as the Iranian government tries to, A, make sense of the coronavirus issue, and, B, figure out if the domestic public in Washington is going to be something that restrains the president from responding to Iranian escalation or something that encourages the president to respond to escalation more strongly. And until the government has a kind of a keener view, we can expect much more of the same.
Behnam Ben Taleblu, thank you also for joining us today. Pleasure to have you on the line.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.